are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 and streaming live on the web at KFAI. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right On Radio, Annie Harview will be working with Mindy Greeling, a member of the Minnesota House of Representatives for 20 years, to discuss the book, her book, Fix What You Can. She helped found the nation's first state mental health caucus, which successfully lobbied for a significant increase in Minnesota's mental health funding. She has served on state and national boards of the National Alliance on Mental Illness and is on the University of Minnesota Psychiatry Community Advisory Council.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Ian Graham Leask and I will be doing a reading from James Joyce's The Dead and having a conversation about the Twelfth Night or Epiphany Eve. We will talk about its cultural significance, why it's not as common as it once was, and why we should still have it. All this and more, so stay tuned to Right On Radio.
Hi, this is Annie Harview, welcoming Mindy Greeling here to Right On Radio. She's the author of Fix What You Can, a work of nonfiction about her experience with schizoaffective disorder in her family, and additionally on the larger American political scale. Mindy, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you just fine. And by the way, it's Greeling. It rhymes with smiling, I always like to say.
Oh, I love that. Thank you.
Great.
Well, Mindy Greeling is right here with us. I appreciate, as someone else with a weird last name, I appreciate hearing that. if you could just give us a little introduction to the book, the project, just tell us a little bit about it. And if you could read maybe a page or so from the book as an introduction, that would be wonderful.
Okay. Actually, I don't have the book right here. Do you want, I can
run
and get one.
No worries. You could just tell us a little bit about it. Don't worry about it at all.
Okay. Sorry about that.
Oh, no worries.
The book spans 20 years, and it starts when our son first is becoming ill and when he's diagnosed with schizophrenia first and then schizoaffective disorder, which is a combination of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And then I take us through the years when he's doing pretty poorly at times, and then other times really well. It's kind of a roller coaster. And I include a lot about my work in the legislature. Unlike most normal families, I was lucky to be serving in the legislature, so I could go to the Minnesota House of Representatives every time we ran into a snag and do something about it. So that was something I felt really good about, because I didn't feel really good at all about what was going on at home with our son getting sicker and sicker. And then some stability for a time, and then due to a med stop medication that he was on stopping working for him, he got allergic to it. And also he's always had trouble with using drugs, but that got worse as time went on. When his meds weren't covering his symptoms, he decided to try using drugs to feel better. And then we had some disastrous years when he was victimized, and also when he committed some crimes, and we ended up then in the judiciary system instead of the mental health system. That's kind of a theme in the book too, that we need to have a better mental health system. So many people like our son don't end up in the criminal court instead of a hospital when they're really sick.
Yes. Thank you so much for that great summary and for pulling out a lot of the key themes of the book. I think this book is a really, really powerful testament to what can be possible if people are given, for example, jobs and communities rather than just more and more incarceration. To dive kind of right into the topic of working with mental illness and working around mental illness, you mention in the book's preface that Jim, who's your son and who lives with schizoaffective disorder, took multiple passes of the book as an editor and as a content advisor. Were there contributions or corrections he made that kind of surprised you or changed your mind about how you perceived a given thing?
One thing that he really hit hard upon that made me feel good, actually, in some ways, was he said he realized just how much his father and I and his sister suffered along with him with his illness. You know, when you're suffering with something like a serious mental illness, hard to realize what else is going on in the world because you're suffering so much.
Yeah.
But he had empathy for us. And then in talking with him, you know, there were many parts that I was writing about, especially at the beginning, where I just wanted to shake him. Or a stage of grief is anger, first and then anger. And sometimes we were just so mad at him. Really, we were mad at his illness.
Yeah.
But in discussing it, when he was looking through the chapters, then we had, and I had more empathy for him because he wasn't doing those things that seemed mean to us on purpose. He was thinking he had to do them because of his delusion.
Yeah.
So we all just ended up with a lot more understanding and other things. He corrected some facts and also commented a lot on the quality of my writing. He would grade the chapters, you know, and that was how he felt, how interesting he thought the chapters were and how well they flowed. So it was really a lot of fun and a bonding experience, really, for our whole family. Eventually, my husband read the book. Our daughter is an editor, and she certainly edited and read the manuscript too. So it was a family thing, but Jim was the most crucial because if he hadn't agreed to some of the more graphic passages, I would really had to think hard about including them. But he really, even though he didn't like all those spots and he felt that they were very negative about his life, he also wanted to help others.
Oh, that's so wonderful. And it sounds like your family was able to create a really synergistic way to tell this story where it wasn't someone really fully capitalizing on it, but more of a communal creation and experience.
That's a really good way to put it.
Thank you. To which I'd love to add, it was very clear to me as I read this book that, like, of course, there's the act of living with a mental illness and telling your own story. But then there's what you are doing in this book, which is living near and working to protect someone living with a mental illness. And there's kind of therein, which you touched on a lot in your last answer already, a balance between allowing the person living with the mental illness to speak for themselves, but also acknowledging that that's not your life and that's not your experience and you're adjacent to it and connected to it, but it's not quite yours. As you were writing on this project, how did you determine your voice's role in this mental health narrative?
That's a really good question because that evolved. I started out, you know, mostly just writing down the facts. You know, it's a big job at the beginning just to get everything straight. You know, what happened? When did it happen? Where did it happen? Who was there?
Yeah.
And so I had actually three professional editors in addition to beta readers like my daughter, who is a professional editor, and some others. But the ones I actually paid to help kept after me for not including my feelings enough. I was just reporting things as if I were a journalist, but was I really there? And so they would be very critical if I was writing about some very dramatic or tragic scene and I didn't explain to the reader. I didn't let the reader in to how I was feeling. So I really had, that was my biggest struggle to share how I was feeling. I'm just, you know, I'm really not a person who wants to tell everybody exactly how bad I am feeling if I'm feeling really bad.
Yeah.
But with writing, that is the only way I learned to get the reader emotionally involved. And I wanted to do that because I wanted people to internalize the story and feel just like I do that something has to change here.
Yeah. Especially with a story that's so centered around mental health and mental illness, there are those conflicts where the suffering the people house creates great friction with society. And I think that it's important that as someone who's adjacent to it, that you wrote this with honesty and with saying these parts were hard, which was probably hard to admit and talk about as someone who also really loves this person who's suffering. So I thought that was a thing I wanted to mention and a thing I enjoyed.
Thank you. And thank you for reading the whole book. That is commended.
Oh, yeah. I got all the way through to find out minimal spoilers for those who haven't read it yet. It doesn't end up in a neat, shiny bow.
No, that doesn't usually happen with serious mental illness.
No. On that topic, actually, you make it pretty clear in the book that there is not in our current society a cut and dry solution to the challenges of having a severe mental illness. And therefore, we get an ending that doesn't end in a joyful, beautiful castle. What was your process as you chose a story arc for this book and kind of decided where to end?
Well, that evolved too. But I did not even really know what a story arc was till I took classes at the Loft Literary Center.
Oh, nice.
And then I learned about, you know, books having beginnings and then the action heightens and then it relaxes and heightens and relaxes, and chapters have to have those arcs too. So so I really had to think about that, but I wanted to start out with a bang. So I did that when Jim started out with a serious car accident that he caused. And then I just took the chapters that I'd been writing actually for 5 years with my writing group and put them into somewhat of a chronological order. But since you've read the book, you know it doesn't completely follow that. There's a little bit of going back and forth. And then when I got around to wanting to conclude, the last couple of years, things were just happening. And I would go to my writing group and I would say, I'm getting such, you know, it's tragic, but it's good material for my book and for the arc of the book. So I certainly can't end right now. And I wasn't really waiting for a happy ending, but I would have liked that. I had one person who read my book who knows a lot about literature who said, people aren't going to like it if it doesn't have a happy ending. That's how people like books to end. And so I really struggled with that, wanting a happy ending. But finally, someone suggested reading Pauline Boss's book, Ambiguous Loss. And that was the best I could do, was to kind of sum things up where each person was at the end of the book and how we all felt ambiguous about all of our losses, including Jim, and nothing ever quite gets resolved. That's what ambiguous loss is. So I ended it like that. But I am happy to say, had I waited 6 months or the past year, Jim is doing so well right now.
Yay.
Schizophrenia, you know, you just don't know where that could be another year from now. But right now, if I'd waited one more year, we could have had a happier ending. But said that, I have two friends who are authors and have written books about their own family members with illnesses, and they ended with happy endings. They struggled to get those happy endings.
Yeah.
And now their children are doing worse than Jim. So there you go.
Yeah. I have a very different experience with mental illness. I have clinical depression. So like, to me, honestly, finishing the book and having it be like, well, this is kind of forever. And sometimes it's going to be great. And sometimes it's going to be awful. Like that, I felt very seen by that, because I had the realization a few years ago where it's like, this isn't really going to end in any like finality way. Like, I can make things better and I can make things more livable, but there's not always a like the end in script. As someone yourself who has more experience, or at least I would assume has more experience per what you said before, writing legislation than writing memoir, talk about kind of the legislation you mentioned writing in the book and then kind of trying to transition that narrative and transition those thoughts into a long family memoir for a large audience.
Well, first of all, I just want to say thank you for sharing about your mental illness. That's exactly what one of the big lessons that I'm trying to get across in this book is that if we all share our stories, then everyone will know how common mental illness is, and then maybe we can have a critical mass and we can do more about it.
Yes.
But as far as the legislature goes, I initially wasn't even going to include the legislature, but my writing group and convinced me that that was where I had a niche. You know, lots of people could write about their illnesses, but not everyone could write about the legislature. But I had to struggle to do that because that was a place that I thought I had left, and I kind of closed doors and wanted to just write this. But it turned out to be very cathartic too, because I realized then, which I hadn't realized when I was living it, that was where I found my comfort all along, was being able to do something. As I said at the beginning, you know, everybody isn't that lucky. So I could be in the swamp at home with everything going wrong, or Jim being in a medical facility and no one listening to me, even though I'm the one that raised him. And often he wanted me involved, but the mental health community isn't open always to families, especially if someone gets older. So I could go to the legislature and actually take out my frustration and do some good. Mm-hmm. So the Mental Health Caucus that you mentioned at the beginning, that was my way of gathering my friends in the legislature. And when you're talking mental illness, you have friends in both the Democrat and Republican Party and people from all over the state, just like anything. When you really start talking about it, there's more commonalities than there are differences if people aren't trying to be partisan. And so mental illness is certainly an issue that should not be partisan. So we could work together, and different people resonated more with some issues than others. But, you know, one of the things that really resonated with Republicans and Democrats, and certainly me, and I'm a Democrat, is the importance of work for people with mental illness. A lot of people historically realized that it was good for people to work in the old state hospitals. People worked in the kitchen, on the farm, and everything. And then there was a movement where it was considered cruel and unusual punishment to have people working in places like that and not being paid. But so then the upshot was they got rid of the work altogether. And then there got to be thinking that maybe people with mental illness shouldn't work at all. It was too much stress. But it's clearly our experience, and there's lots of research actually, that shows work for people with mental illness, like anyone else, increases your self-esteem, how you feel about yourself, your reason to get up in the morning, structure in the day. A lot of people now with the COVID situation are realizing it's very disorienting and unsettling when you don't have your regular routines, or if you can't go to work, or you can't be around other people. And so that's one of the things that we legislators could agree on bipartisanly. The one issue that was that kind of fractured the mental health community didn't fracture the legislators. They got it. And that was the idea of getting help for people who didn't realize they were sick. That was an issue that we ran into, and it was a controversial piece of legislation because the patients' rights groups or civil liberties groups. But legislators, because they could see how I was suffering and how other legislative families who shared their stories were suffering when they couldn't do anything and the person didn't know they were sick and they were getting worse and worse. I think the society is passing that issue on to a more normal solution nowadays than we were before, because there's more visibility that huge problems happen if people don't get help and they're seriously ill. But when I was first working on that, that was a fracturous issue, but legislators seemed to get it. And we were able to pass lots of legislation. So I could do a story arc though with especially that civil commitment legislation where we couldn't get a hearing. There was the groups that were opposed to it, stifled the bill. And gradually, as people became informed and legislators heard from constituents, the story arc there was successful. And then that led into, well, we can't just do that. It's not a panacea. You have to have a whole mental health system with a continuum of services. And legislators of all stripes and all around the state came forward and helped with that. And I'm happy to say that is continuing on. Now there's lots of legislators plugged into the mental health issue and the need for affordable housing and employment and all the things that go with it. So that is a really successful story arc compared to any individual story like the Grylings and how Jim is doing.
Yeah, for sure. I think that I just want to commend quickly how well in the book you depict both Jim's how much better Jim is feeling when he's plugged into a community and into a daily structure and things like that. I think the book did a really good job of showing what that looks like on a day-to-day basis, even though it didn't take up wild amounts of real estate in the book. And I think that it's really valuable to have that positive example in the world of just showing what that's like. And then additionally, I'm glad you ended up including the stuff about the legislature because it... it added such a good compliment to your character in the book in that you were trying to think about and process and solve this situation in multiple areas of your life. And you were never taking it and turning it off and putting it out of your mind, per se, as much as you were rolling it into different scenarios. And I thought that was something that made this book really interesting because mental illness is often political. And I like that you're trying to make it less political by bringing it into these things. But the act of having a family member who's experiencing that in this country, in the way our country is right now, it's a little political. So, kind of rolling on that theme, with that victory and increasing Minnesota's mental illness funding under your belt and the stuff you've done with the National Alliance on Mental Illness and the University of Minnesota, it kind of feels to me like this book could fit in the larger umbrella or universe of mental illness advocacy goals. And I was just wondering, both when you were starting this project and now, do you consider it more that way, more of a family story, or like neither of those in a particularly binary way?
Well, I kind of did the family story as a mode to the advocacy.
Mm-hmm.
I just read a book recently about it was written by Eleanor Roosevelt, one of her autobiography books. And she said in that book that when she wanted to do action on a problem, what could actually move her the most to action was finding somebody who was living that problem, just one person, and then talking to them. And then she could understand it from that one person's point of view, that one story, and then she could move on to action.
Yeah.
And, legislators are so barraged with facts and figures, and, you hear from hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, what will really stop the show in a legislative hearing is just one person speaking from the heart about their personal situation. All of a sudden, legislators will stop looking in their phones or shuffling through their papers. And then there's some listening and going on. And so I wanted this to just be one story. I didn't want to include the facts and figures. There is a study guide that goes with it if it's being used in a college class, which it is being used in some. Concordia University is actually using it with lots of professors and students and using the study guide. But I wanted just this one story. Mm-hmm. And then my hidden goal, or my maybe not so hidden, because you got it quite clearly here, is for action. And I did serve on the national and state NAMI board, as you said, and currently I'm the president of my county NAMI, Ramsey County. Mm-hmm. And so we are actually lobbying the county to do some things that would help the mental health system. So I'm now active at that level. I also worked with my two state legislators, my senator and representative. Just last week, we were on a Zoom call talking about some legislation to decriminalize the mental health system. So there's always things you can do. There's so many things that could use fixing in the mental health system. There's something there to fit almost anybody's interest. But that's always been my life plan for this book, is to enable me to talk about mental illness more, as like I did when I was in the legislature, and to help legislators who were there, to help at the local level. Mm-hmm. And I've gotten involved in some national things as a result of this book, which is even exceeding the goal that I had.
That's so wonderful. It's really great to just think about this book as being another tool in the world, trying to decriminalize mental illness and giving people a really detailed and compassionate look about what they're criminalizing when they criminalize mental illness and what they're providing someone instead of a more direct form of help. And kind of running with that momentum, I just want to ask you one last question as we wrap up here. Do you have any advice for people who might be interested in writing a mental illness story of their own or of a loved one?
Well, I would say if you live in Minnesota, head to the Loft Literary Center. And
nice.
If you don't, a comparable place in your state. And then also journal, because that helped me more than anything when I started writing, was that I've always been a journaler. So I kept a diary when I was young. I burned all those after I got older. Some of my kids wouldn't read them. But once Jim got sick, I started keeping a spiral notebook, just writing down the things I wanted to remember about where he was and the numbers and the doctors and all of that. But then I very quickly started pouring my heart into those pages and how I felt. And I also included even some direct quotes of things Jim said, things I said, things our family members said, or doctors or case managers said. And that was like a gold mine when I went to write. So if anyone's interested, journal, because that will trigger your memory and your creative juices. And then just be willing always to tell your story, because bottling this up doesn't help you, doesn't help your family member, mm-hmm. and certainly doesn't help improve the mental health system.
Well, thank you so much. I think everyone now has a reason to journal, whether it's because they can make an amazing book someday or because they can make a great bonfire.
But, there you go.
But this has been such a wonderful interview. It's really been a joy to have you on the show, and I'm sorry to let you go. Thank you so much for coming here.
Thank you, Annie. Thanks for reading the book and being such a great interviewer.
Thank you very much. It's been great, and take care. Have a good night.
All right. You too.
Welcome back, everyone. This is Right on Radio. I am one of your co-hosts, Josh Weber, and here in studio with us is our resident Joycean researcher, Ian Graham-Leesk. Hello.
Good to be. I haven't been here for several weeks. It's good to be here in a different capacity, not hosting, but talking to you.
Just having a brief conversation.
Yeah. I'm going to have a chat about Little Christmas.
Christmas, and I know you asked me a couple weeks ago about to do this conversation revolving around this time of year, the 12th night.
Well, what's interesting is every year, you know, everybody's got a pet peeve. And you think of Christmas, and we sing this song, The 12 Days of Christmas, and, you know, Partridge in a Pear Tree, and yada, yada, yada. And everybody around here, at least, not everybody, but most people around here, I look in my back alley in South Minneapolis, and the day after Christmas, half the houses have put their Christmas tree outside. And there's this beautiful Christmas tree sitting out by the garbage. And of course, the whole point of Christmas is this 12 days, and it goes through Epiphany, which is the 6th of January. And people can do whatever they want, of course, who cares? But I don't know, if it's a Christmas season. And for many years, you know, for centuries, 12th night is really important night in the Christmas calendar. It's the last night of Christmas. 12th night is when you have your party, your last party, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit tonight with James Joyce's wonderful short story, The Dead. We're going to chat about that, and you're going to read something from it, which will be fun to have you read it in your lovely voice. But it was always a smashing time of the Christmas period when you take down the decorations and you actually turned out the lights on the tree, or of course back when this story happened, if there was a tree, you would take out the candles, unlight the candles, take it all apart. You take Christmas apart on the last day of Christmas. And it used to be a thought that if you missed it, you were going to get the rest of the year as really rotten luck. You know, so ridiculous superstition. But at the same time, I don't know, it sticks with me because as a kid, I was always told that. You're going to get bad luck this year if you don't honour the 12th night of Christmas, which after all is Epiphany. And that's when the baby Christ is born and when the three wise men come to see him. And, you know, the story by Joyce, it doesn't really deal so much with all of that. It deals with much more ironic and literary systems. But the story takes place on Epiphany, the last day of Christmas, and what the Irish and many English call Little Christmas. And I've heard it used here too, Little Christmas, the last night of Christmas, the 12th night.
You know, and something I didn't really realize just how relevant this really is, but the literary device that Joyce uses in Dubliners, and especially in The Dead, Epiphany is a driving force for that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
The short story of The Dead, it expresses the paralysis of Epiphany Joyce's character feels when Gabriel Conroy, his stand-in, I guess, mm-hmm. has revelation about a past lover his wife has. Yeah. This whole night he's been lusting after her and realizes that this whole night she's been comparing him to this other individual who's been gone for a very long time.
Well, what happens in the story is that they go to Twelfth Night in all innocence, in a typical sort of upper middle class Twelfth Night party, which is a little boy I attended before my insane parents, you know, imploded, and there were some of those kinds of things where people really dress up for it. There'd be a great big huge dinner, a great big board, you know, and several different joints to carve and eat, music, singing, and dancing if there was room, and all sorts of things like that. It was literally the celebration of the end of Christmas, a celebration of the birth of the baby Jesus. And some families were more religious than others, and it is Epiphany. And what happens in the story The Dead, which is one of my favourite short stories ever out of the thousands that I've read since getting interested in literature, the character, Gabriel, has this epiphany that changes the position that he's in his life. And it doesn't happen to his wife, Greta, that she begins to think about her lost love, as it were, a fellow called Michael Fury, who is probably only about 17 and is sickly and comes to throw stones at her window before she leaves for a convent. And she's not going to be a nun, but she, as a lot of Irish girls would do, she'd retire to a convent for a certain period of time. And he catches his death of cold from that and dies. And all the way through this story, Gabriel has been setting up, or is being set up by the author. And I don't know that it's Gabriel is necessarily the Joyce counterpart. Is maybe partly, but certainly in his jealousy at the end of the story. He was a very jealous man, Joyce. And indeed, Nora Barnacle, his wife, was from the west of Ireland. And that's certainly part of the story. But Joyce wasn't really a Gabriel. He wasn't tall and heavy like this, like the character of Gabriel. He wasn't pompous. And this character is quite pompous without even meaning to be. He's very good-natured, but he's also very class-conscious, very pompous, as he's called in the story. He's kind of a West Briton. He's sort of on the side of the English. And this is before there's a change in the country where the Irish, at least the southern counties, are given independence by the British, or in fact they force independence from the British. But the epiphany part of this happens after she's heard a song by a very famous singer by the name of Darcy. And he sings the partial part of a song this boy, Michael Fury, used to sing. And it just catches her. And it ruins the night. Epiphany for her too. She's got this middle class life, wonderful life, really, and it catches her. And you don't see what's inside her. It's a typical, wonderful, absolutely brilliant show don't tell by Joyce the Craftsman. You don't see inside her unless she can tell you a little bit, which she does at the end of the story. And he doesn't, the character Gabriel, who has most of the story, he doesn't twig to what's going on with her, not at all. And he starts to look at her. She sees that she's beautiful. It's the end of the night. He's so happy to be her husband. And he starts feeling quite amorous. It's quite carefully, beautifully written how he feels this surge of sexual desire for her. And it all comes crashing down when he gets her back to the hotel and feels he needs to have an entrance into, you know, sort of beginning to make love to her, and asks her what she's thinking. Big mistake, she tells him, and she tells him the story of Michael Fury, and that's the epiphany in the story. It turns his life upside down, and it probably grows him up, if nothing else. But one of the things that, the reason I said all that is that you're going to read a passage, I think, from his speech that he makes. And in it, you will see a tremendous foreshadowing of what I just mentioned.
And from here, we'll segue to the reading.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, a new generation has grown up in our midst, a generation actuated by new ideas and new principles. It is serious and enthusiastic for these new ideas and its enthusiasm, even when it is misdirected. It is, I believe, in the main sincere. But we are living in a skeptical and, if I may use the phrase, a thought-tormented age. And sometimes I fear that this new generation, educated or hyper-educated as it is, will lack those qualities of humanity, of hospitality, of kindly humor, which belong to an older day. Listening tonight to the names of all those great singers of the past, it seemed to me, I must confess, that we are living in a less spacious age. Those days might, without exaggeration, be called spacious days. And they are gone beyond recall. Let us hope, at least, that in gatherings such as this, we shall speak of them with pride and affection, still cherish in our hearts the memory of those dead and gone great ones whose fame the world will not willingly let die. "Hear, hear," said Mr. Brown loudly. "But yet," continued Gabriel, his voice falling into a sober inflection, "there are always in gatherings such as this sadder thoughts that will recur into our minds, thoughts of the past, of youth, of changes, of absent faces that we miss here tonight. Our path through life is strewn with many such sad memories, and were we to brood upon them always, we cannot find the heart to go on bravely with our work among the living. We have all of us living duties and living affections which claim, and rightly claim, our strenuous endeavors. Therefore, I will not linger on the past. I will not let any gloomy moralizing intrude upon us here tonight. Here we are gathered together for a brief moment from the bustle and rush of our everyday routine. We are met here as friends, in the spirit of good fellowship, as colleagues, also to a certain extent, in the true spirit of camaraderie, and as the guests of, what I shall call them, the three graces of Dublin musical world. The table burst into applause and laughter at this allusion. Aunt Julia vainly asked each of her neighbors in turn to tell her what Gabriel had said. "He says we are three graces, Aunt Julia," said Mary Jane. Aunt Julia did not understand, but she looked up, smiling at Gabriel, who continued in the same vein.
See, that's what's so interesting about that as you read it, is that he's walking right into this psychological buzzsaw at the end of the story, because he's talking about the dead and talking about let's not look into the past. And of course, that's exactly what his wife ends up doing and what he is forced to do and is driven back into it. And the end of the last few lines of the story, which I'll read in my English accent, which I'm not going to try and do an Irish accent because they always accuse me of sounding partly like Donegal and partly like Dublin, so I'm not even going to try it. But the last part of the short story, or might be even call it a novella, is him reacting to what he's learned, what we talked about earlier, and contrasts with what you've just read. It's no longer this wonderful
optimism
and the rest of it. A few light taps upon the pane made him turn to the window. It had begun to snow again. He watched sleepily the flakes, silver and dark, falling obliquely against the lamplight. The time had come for him to set out on his journey westward. Yes, the newspapers were right. Snow was general all over Ireland. It was falling on every part of the dark central plain, on the treeless hills, the fallings and falling softly upon the Bog of Allen, and further westward, softly falling into the dark, mutinous Shallon waves. It was falling, too, upon every part of the lonely churchyard on the hill where Michael Fury lay buried. It lay thickly drifted on the crooked crosses and headstones, on the spears of the little Kate, on the barren thorns. His soul swooned slowly as he heard the snow falling faintly through the universe, and faintly falling, like the descent of their last end upon all the living and the dead. And that's a famous ending, you know, to the story, which seems to abide for every literary person that wants to have anything to do with Twelfth Night or Epiphany. So that's how the whole thing connects.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Yeah.
I was kind of curious, when did you first encounter the dead? What was your first moment, I guess, was this a literary epiphany for you to discover?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. I think it, real briefly, a lot of people listening would, the old generation, I suppose, would know who Chester Anderson was. He's unfortunately deceased now, but he was, I studied under him at University of Minnesota when I was an undergraduate. And he was absolutely marvelous lecturer, and he brought this story alive. It was a sort of 1 year course in Joyce, and I took all of that and with him. And the way that he brought forth the concept of what Little Christmas was extraordinary. And the way he read it, he could do it in Irish accent. He was a Midwesterner, Minnesotan, and. But he was in love with Ireland, and he could do the accent very well. And he'd read the whole story to you as part of the class, one whole class. I mean, to read the whole thing takes, you know, a full class period. And to read, follow along, listen, and to be able to see all the nuances of what was taking place underneath the surface with Joyce, a craftsman who much prefers to show you what's going on than tell you directly what's going on. Little things like in the beginning of the story, Gabriel comes in, he's very well dressed, and there's a maid that he knew when she was a little girl holding a rag doll. And he notices that she's grown up now, which gives you a little hint that he's got an eye for the feminine form, shall we say. He notices her figure and how strong and lithe she is. And he says, I don't suppose it'll be very long before I'm attending your wedding. And she turns over her shoulder and says to him, basically, that's not likely. All the men want from you is something, what they can get out of you and nothing else. And it ruins his night. And I had never thought about anything like that. I'd never thought about having my night ruined by a woman saying something honest like that. And you watch how this character is so sensitive, he's noticing everything. And this story, The Dead, was one of the first times when I really got hold of the concept of that depth that an author can find through using the fictional form to teach us things. It was so eye-opening, and also the jealousy at the end that comes in at the end of the book, the heartbreaking, head-spinning sense of, oh, the woman I love has once loved someone else. Mm. I think all human beings are capable of that, but especially men, and especially men who are a little naive. It kills you to know that the woman that you love, or the person that you love, has been intimate with somebody else. And he's spinning it. He's turned around this character from a place of great generosity and love of the moment, joie de vivre, into lying in bed and thinking about going westward, which essentially means time for me to start going to the darkness, time for me to enter the valley of death. You know, it's very morose at the end of this, which is not always what you'd expect from Little Christmas. Little Christmas is supposed to be a fairly joyful time. So to answer your question, it completely moved me as a man and as a person studying literature, and later, and of course, as somebody who then taught literature and now as a publisher.
This makes me kind of wonder then, when you, in the past, in years past, you would do readings of the dead for different people around this season, around this time.
Yeah.
What were their reactions to it if they hadn't heard it before?
Well, it was interesting. I don't do it anymore, but at my house we'd have a gathering of some of my students partly at the behest of Chester Anderson, my old professor, one of my favorite professors. He kind of, by his example, had taught me how to teach. One of the things he would always do would to bring his students to his house. And, you know, it was wonderful. And everybody would come and they'd bring spout. Everybody was welcome. And all he had to do was bring something to drink and he'd supply the food. And it was fantastic. So I started to do that later on when I got older and got into a position of authority, and that went started to teach. And then many of my friends, some of them have been graduate students with me at the U, and we'd all get together. Well, everybody loved Joyce. And then we had a piano, and my ex-wife would play the bang out things on the piano. We'd do exactly what happened in the story, except for perhaps the highfalutin speeches and the fancy clothes. Because we were all students, and or you know, young teachers, young graduate students, and the rest of it. So we didn't have any money, but I would read the whole story, or most of it. I'd read the relevant parts, and often would read that passage that you just read, not as well as you did. But I stopped doing it because nobody really cares about Twelfth Night anymore. The Epiphany thing is really dissipating and going away. And I noticed that rereading the story for our work tonight, everything felt really different to me with the story. I read it hundreds of times, probably 50 times in my life. And it was still completely new reading it again. And especially the part about things fading that he has in the end of the speech. And how it's important to try and keep things remembered as long as you can. Because Chester Anderson is fading. He's gone, nobody remembers him. And I will go, nobody will remember me. Nobody will remember the stories that I would tell, or the soiree nights when I'd read that. And nobody would remember those wonderful, you know, wine-filled nights of laughter and teasing and all those kinds of things taking place. And the story, to a great extent, is there just to remind you of your mortality, and that nothing really lasts and everything gets covered in snow. And that's the point of the snow falling on everything. So, yeah.
I don't know why, but I was kind of... The reason I ask you this, because I wonder, as a culture at large, towards the end of year, into the new year, we're always fixated on the future and rebirth and rejuvenation. I think it's something we want to better ourselves. We don't want to dwell on the past. And I think Epiphany is the whole purpose behind it, is revelation and reflecting on something about yourself that maybe you don't want to deal with. And I think that's almost an anathema to everything that we're trying to do. So I think it's a good thing to remember.
Well, I agree. And it's always puzzled me that the story's not more upbeat. I suspect that he probably wrote a version of it that was more upbeat and then decided, being him, but Joyce, that no, that's not good enough for a literary fellow like me, and I'm going to make it miserable. And I got to admit, and I think most of us would agree, we prefer miserable stories to uplifting ones, don't we? I mean, because they teach us more.
There's a truth in there.
Yeah, there was truth
in it. People like to not address.
For me, to have this chance to sit down with you and talk about this, and we don't get with the work that we do, we don't get a chance often to really dig into great literature. It was exhilarating to get back into it and to reread the story and to find, shall I say, a better word is discover the newness in it, and to reread things that you love, reread things that you think you've read and you haven't stayed up with them. They change as you get older. You know, read your favourite book that you say, oh, that was my favourite book. You read it 10 years ago. Read it again. You won't remember any of it. You know, and I studied this thing up the yin-yang and the Ulysses and several of these things. I reread them again and they're brand new. You know, my brain just cannot hold what I sort of think it can hold if I stand away from it. Oh, have you read Dickens's Pickwick Papers? Yeah, I read that. Now do a test on it. You'll get nothing. It's all gone. Mm. You read it again, and it's best to remember the books that you loved, because those are the ones to read again, because you loved when you read them. And that's a good reminder that there's probably still something there for you to try it again.
I think on that note, it's a really good place to rest it off.
All right.
The dead is very still alive, I think.
I hope so. And good reading of the speech.
Thank you. And now this. Listening to Right on Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Josh Weber. I'd like to thank our guest tonight, Mindy Grayling, plus our listeners who make this show possible. Without your support and donations, KFAI would not be possible. You can find more news and info about Right on Radio at KFAI.org/program/Right on Radio. Plus, listen to recent episodes on our recently launched podcast found on Spotify, iTunes, and anywhere podcasts can be found. Now stay tuned to Bonjour, Minnesota.